Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. Tajikistan is conducting parliamentary elections on March 2nd. It's really a meaningless event. The Tajik government is one of the most repressive governments in Central Asia, alongside Turkmenistan. Just in the first few weeks of 2025, there were reminders of how far the rule of law has sunk in Tajikistan. Former government officials and opposition politicians were convicted in a sham trial held behind closed doors, where they were convicted and given ridiculously long prison sentences. So was a young journalist who is also the mother of two small children and now faces 8 years in prison. There's more, and during this session of the Mejlis Podcast, we will look at the recent moves of the Tajik government to crush even the slightest potential challenge to the corrupt and abusive regime that runs the country. To discuss all this, I am joined by Muhammad Jan Kabirov, editor at Azda TV, a media outlet run by people who were forced to flee Tajikistan, Edward Lemon, the president of Washington-based Oxa Society for Central Asian Affairs and research assistant professor at the Bush School of Government and Public Service, and Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer, veteran defender of human rights in Central Asia, who's currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. Thank you all for joining me. Edward, I wonder if you can take us through the court trials of the former officials and opposition politicians.
Well, as you said, the allegations against the defendants was that they organized a coup attempt back in the summer of 2024. And at that time, we saw the arrest of numerous former and even fitting government officials and parliamentarians who were all accused of being involved in attempting to overthrow the government. The alleged ringleader, Syed Jafar Osmanzadeh, is a veteran Tajik politician, former leader of the Democratic Party of Tajikistan that at one point was part of the coalition that was fighting against the current government of Tajikistan during the civil war, but was brought in as part of the peace deal in 1997, along with other parties such as the Islamic Renaissance Party. But he was accused of being the supposed ringleader. But as you mentioned, various other individuals were accused of being involved in this, including the deputy leader of the Social Democratic Party, Shokhejon Hakimov. His daughter was the journalist you mentioned who was arrested. The former Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hamilkhan Zarifi. So relatively prominent government individuals, even someone who was at one point the acting former chairman of the Supreme Council in Tajikistan, Mansur Gandarov. So very prominent politicians, all of whom were arrested and accused of treason. As you said, the charges very much trumped up. The political system in the country, of course, viewed in favor of the interests of the ruling elite. And ultimately, this was more about purging these individuals from their roles in government and society rather than an actual attempt. This is more about paving the way for the long-expected transition from Mali Rahmon to his son, Rustam.
Thank you. Muhammad Jan, I'd like to get your thoughts on the recent trials, too. You know, some of these politicians and some of the people that were convicted, Edward mentioned Akbar Show Iskandarov. He hasn't even been politically active, really, since he finished his acting term as president, you know, in 1992. I mean, how did the government explain that these people are all connected to each other in an attempt to stage a coup?
This is one of the mysterious trials. It is very difficult since the court was behind doors and also accusation all is fabricated. That's a good question, how to connect this opposition in the co-accusation. For example, Akbar Show Iskandarov, he was acting president during 1991 and 1992. And he was retired and he's very old. And Hamrokhan Zarifi, he's a former Minister of Foreign Affairs, which served of the entire his career during the independence for the Rahmon government or regime. So that's kind of not fitting in one thing, but also it is not for the government of Tajikistan. When they decide to arrest you, they will accuse you whatever they want. For example, formerly they accuse former Minister of Industry, Zaid Saidov, for the crime which he never committed. That's why this is not something new when the government tried to punish. But we have heard some rumors saying that some of these people, during the close meeting, told some jokes about Rahman, and some of the people revealed these jokes to other people, and that's why they were imprisoned or arrested.
Okay, thank you. Steve, of all the people that were just convicted, Shakir John Hakima, who's the deputy chairman of the Social Democratic Party of Tajikistan, he might be the only one that you could say was actually a prominent voice that challenged the government recently. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Shakir John, you're right that he was, even in a sort of muted and modest way, he was a prominent commentator for Radio Free Europe and Radio Ozodi. You know, he was extremely learned. He is extremely learned. He's a PhD in jurisprudence. He was a professor and affiliated with the Social Democratic Party, and just a person with a reputation of sharp wit and great intelligence, someone that could have fled the country long ago, but really decided that he would stay. He would do his best to shed light on what was happening in his country. And he got an 18-year sentence. I mean, this is someone that it's absolutely absurd. I mean, I think as you outlined in the beginning, Bruce, these sentences are ridiculously long. When we look at the length from, 27 years at the top of the list down to, I think, when we look at later at the case of Rukhshona Hakimova, 8 years. These are so long that I think we're at a point now where we have to say that Tajikistan may have actually surpassed Turkmenistan as the leader in Central Asian repression with the longest sentences in the region. And we've got so many to choose from, unfortunately. But I think it's the cruelty is the point. As Muhammad John was saying and Ed were saying, there's no credible allegations here. There's no real evidence. And the charges, in essence, don't really matter, whether it's extortion or it's extremism. The Tajik authorities are interested in sending a message that there is no dissent allowed. And there could be some speculation about what this trial was really about. You know, some have pointed to an attempt to send a message to Saimomin Yatimov, who everyone has been waiting to see sort of arrested or anticipating that he could be arrested. He's the powerful security chief in Tajikistan. He hasn't yet been, but there's always constant speculation that he could be. Some have said that by going after Sayyid Jafar Osmonzodah, that was meant to send a message to him and his clan not to interfere with this transition to power that we're also waiting to see take place. But I think at the end of the day, Bruce, cruelty is the point, repression is the point, and Shakir John Hakimov is really an example of someone being crushed for no reason other than, the exercise of free expression in the country.
Okay, thank you. I want to focus just a minute on the way these trials are conducted, because this one is not what I suppose you could say is traditional for the Tajik judiciary. So, Edward, in this case, the last reports I saw, there was some of these suspects, I think they were the former GKN Bay security colonels, and they weren't even sure what the sentence was. Some we knew how many years they got in prison, but there was a couple people that no one was really sure how long their prison sentences, the terms were. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of these closed-door trials and what we do know about it, why we can't get any information about them? Disclosure agreements, things like that.
Well, I think as others have said, these kind of closed trials have become the norm in Tajikistan when it comes to these kind of high-profile cases of individuals who are accused of extremism, terrorism, coups, cases that have drawn international attention and where the charges are falsified and politically motivated. So there's obviously a desire on the part of the Tajik government not to have any transparency, not to allow journalists or others to report on the proceedings. There's no desire to have any kind of accountability or transparency on the part of the government. Unfortunately, this has, as Steve said, become very much a pattern in Tajikistan, and arguably its trajectory is amongst the worst in the region.
Muhammad John, if I can get your thoughts on this too. This, as Edward said, this isn't the first time these trials have been held. Can you take me back to 2015, 2016? Talk about some of the trials they had after they banned the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, for example.
Sure, but I think the trials, such a closed-door trials are started long ago, when the Mohammad Reza Iskandarov, the first leader of the Democratic Party after the peace deal, was extradited illegally from Russia to Tajikistan, and he was sentenced to 20 some years, 28 I think, or 24, I'm not sure, but he supposedly to be freed this last year in 2024, but unfortunately for unknown reason his term was extended for unknown period, so he has been in prison for 21 years now. So it started all the way back into 2004. So, and then we saw the court of the Zayed Saidov, the leader of party New Tajikistan, and then IRPT leaders were trialed behind the closed doors for 14 members of the Supreme Council of the IRPT. And then Group 24, you know, the lawyers, Buzurg Mehyarov, Nurdin Makhamov, and then the government came after the journalist. And also many others, like students who studied abroad in Islamic country, and also Muslim Brotherhood, like and then Pamiri minorities in 2022 were imprisoned behind closed door, like Fathoni Mamatshoeva and many others were among them. And then we saw journalists, and you know, this is ongoing crackdown on civil society, because the government, the regime, feel free to do to practice that, and no one is there to hold the government or the Rahmon regime accountable. And the international community also closing eyes and not paying much attention. No one is sanctioned by the Western country. None of the Rahmon regime ministers or human rights abusers were sent sanctioned by the international community. So why they should be transparent? Why? So there is no force to account, to hold accountable the regime. That's why they are becoming more harsh and more harsh.
Steve, we'll come back to you. Could you, you know, we haven't talked so much about Rukhshona Hakimova to this point. Can you explain her case and what it involves?
I'm glad that you raised her case. Rukhshona really embodies, again, the cruelty of these types of prosecutions. She's 31 years old, the mother of an infant and another young child, who, again, was sentenced in a sort of shadowy, murky way connected to this trial. She happens to be the niece of Shakirjon Hakimov. And as we've seen before, repression in Tajikistan can often be a family affair. I believe he's also related, if I'm not mistaken, to Saeed Jafar Usmonzoda. So there's a sort of, you know, nebulous relationship here. Perhaps the family connection has something to do with this. But what we know is that Rukhshona worked as a journalist and as a researcher. And some have reported that she was conducting a survey for a company based in Kyrgyzstan that included questions to talking heads and experts in Tajikistan about Beijing's influence and activities in China, and sort of popular or local opinion regarding China's influence in Tajikistan, which is, you know, by no means were these questions top secret, or the questions that we've learned about, you know, things like, you know, what's your opinion of China's influence in the country? Things that I would say are pretty far from state secrets. And yet it seems that that was more than enough to put her in the crosshairs of the security services. And she was also accused of treason, along with the others in this trial, although it was somewhat of a separate process because she was arrested later. And what she's come to symbolize, though, is just the unabashed cruelty, in the sense that you have a young mother. There was a small reprieve for her to be under house arrest during the trial. But as she was arrested, there was a photo that emerged of her wearing two earrings. You know, I think it was embracing her children. And those earrings have become a symbol for lots of ordinary Tajiks, especially women inside the country and outside the country, bemoaning just how sad and depressing this fate is, that the regime would have so little compassion and be willing to take this young mother away from her children and sentence her to 8 years. And, you know, we're yet to see if they will release her, you know, or commute her sentence in some way. But again, I think it just shows the state of affairs that Tajikistan has come to. And it reminded others of the other sentencing of a journalist named Ulfathoni Mamatshoeva, now 68 years old, who got a 21-year sentence. She lived in Dushanbe, but she was Pamiri, also essentially accused of treason, not on behalf of China, but perhaps the United States. Also a closed trial, also due process violations. So we have seen, you know, a number of women being targeted in these arrests and these sentences, and they're just absolutely cruel.
Okay, thank you. I want to get a clearer picture of the media situation in Tajikistan for the benefit of our audience. Edwards, I'll turn to you for our first thoughts on this, the first opinions. You know, there was a time after the Civil War where Tajikistan was actually something of a model that was being held up for Central Asia. And one of the reasons that was true is because they did have sort of they had independent media outlets, and there were political parties that had their own newspaper or something that they could disseminate their own message over. Can you kind of walk me through the elimination, the slow whittling down of the media in Tajikistan, and get us to where we are today?
Well, I think, as you said, the situation was better. We got our minds back 20 or even 30 years ago, but it was never, of course, a model of media freedom. There were always restrictions on the press. There were numerous journalists who were killed or disappeared during the Civil War. There was censorship and self-censorship on the part of journalists around the country. But I think, as you said, the situation over time has deteriorated. And for me, an important moment was 2010, when there was a prison break from a high maximum security prison facility in Dushanbe. And then there was an ambush and there were numerous media criticisms by independent journalists of how the government had handled that incident. And that was the first time, as far as I'm aware, that there was kind of mass blocking of news websites, social networks in the country that, of course, has become the norm since then. And over time, the government has cracked down on independent media outlets. Numerous outlets have had to close. Other outlets have had to pivot in directions where they are censoring a lot of their content. And of course, many outlets have been forced outside of the country. But ultimately, over time, what we've seen is a crackdown on media freedoms, the arrest of various journalists, to the extent now that there is no meaningful independent media in the country beyond outlets like Radio Free Europe, Radio Azadi. The space is really shrunk over time.
Okay, thank you. Look, but John, you run a media outlet, or you're an editor at a media outlet that reports, obviously, on Tajikistan a lot, too. I'd like to get your opinion on the media situation in Tajikistan also.
Thank you, Bruce. You know, the media situation last year, it was comparing to Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan had a very media freedom comparing to Tajikistan. And now the situation this year getting worse, according to Reporters Without Borders. And so we don't have, except Radio Free Europe, we don't have any other independent media operating or reporting from Tajikistan. And also, unfortunately, exile media are facing challenge, and we are the only news media reporting from exile, which also facing many pressures. So this is ongoing crackdown since, I don't know, 2015 or even before that. It's difficult to list all these media which were closed, or journalists. For example, I have the list of more than 15 journalists who were imprisoned from starting from Hikmatullah Saifulozada, the editor of Najat, and also Abdul Qahari Dawlat, editor of website of it was a IRPT website, and then you have all these people: Daryl Imam Ali, Zafri Beg, Abdul Sattar, and Mamat Shoeva and Rukhshana. So all these people were just for practicing their professional activities as a journalist were imprisoned. But also, even now the government, by adopting many laws, for example, restricting the citizens, not only persecuting the journalists and media organization, but also, you know, imprisoning or persecuting its own citizens. For example, the government put a list of the banned media in front of the entrance of each mosque, for example, and Azda TV also listed in that list. Whoever watch or like or comment, they will be imprisoned minimum from 5 to 7 years imprisonment for liking, posting, or sharing, banned media or exile media in Tajikistan. So it shows the government not only after media and journalists, but also after their relative, after own citizens. I'm not talking about persecution against our relative back in Tajikistan. They are being ongoingly interrogated because of our reporting, because of our activities as a journalist. So it is a very harsh and difficult situation. Many people are not, unfortunately, aware. When I met with my colleagues from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, when they heard our situation, they are shocked. So it is sad that even our neighbor are not aware of situation. How we could think that the European or Western people know our situation, what we are going through. So it's very unfortunate situation in Tajikistan, and especially on media freedom and journalists. And I don't see much solidarity on imprisoned journalists and support and media freedom. So that's also... So let's shortage. We are the media and journalists imprisoned at home, ignore it abroad. So that's how I describe the situation.
That's grim. A reminder that we're talking about the most recent signs of growing repression in Tajikistan. And my guests are Edward Lemon, the president of the Washington-based Oxus Society for Central Asian Affairs and research assistant professor at the Bush School of Government and Public Service. Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer, veteran defender of human rights in Central Asia, is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. And Muhammad John Kabirov, editor at Azda TV, a media outlet run by exiled Tajik journalists who were forced to flee Tajikistan. Steve, we'll get to you. Let's switch just a little bit here. Now, I mentioned that Tajikistan is having parliamentary elections on March 2nd. There are no genuine opposition parties running in this at all. But what was interesting was that the OSCE at the start of February said that they couldn't go. They didn't have the kind of guarantees they needed to even send observers to the election.
Right, which is striking in the sense that this is the first time that this has happened. And you know, there's never been an election deemed free or fair by the OSCE over the years in Tajikistan, although we may, you know, I mean, and Ed is definitely expert in this, going back to the early days, some after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Tajikistan's first elections were probably the most free and garnered some praise. But now we're at a point in 2025 when the OSCE is unable to even send its delegation. And again, when we see these assessments come out about Tajikistan, I mean, yes, they are critical, but it's not as if those assessments have ever presented some sort of real threat to what the regime wants to do. And so, again, this seems to reflect a level of paranoia of, you know, and we've used this word a lot over the last 10 years, but I think it's really true that we're talking about totalitarianism, not just authoritarianism. We're talking about a political system in which Rahmon is deeply paranoid and willing to brook absolutely no criticism nor observation, apparently. And so I think this is certainly a new low, and it shows, I think it really opens up, again, a lot of risks for this regime in the sense that, you know, when you have no observation, when you have no way to really monitor what's happening inside the system, it just creates more and more questions. And, you know, there have been a lot of disturbing things happening in Tajikistan that we can mention, such as the deaths in prison recently. With so much repression, I think that really opens up a lot of risks, not just abuses. And so I think this was the wrong decision by Dushanbe to do this. And of course, the OSCE and the Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights regretted this publicly. And, you know, hopefully there will be some pressure brought to bear.
Okay, thank you. Edward, I want you to give us a little bit of history. I mean, there was a time right after the Civil War when they held the first presidential elections where the Tajik government was anxious to have international organizations sign off on this election. What does this say about the Rahmon regime? That you know, there was a time when they were practically begging these observers to show up and attend their elections, and now they don't even want international observers to be there at all.
Well, I think at that time in the kind of post-Civil War transition, the peace-building period in the country, there was, you know, a great reliance on external aid and support from the international community. There was a desire on the part of the Rahmon government to normalize itself and become accepted in the international community. And as a result, they wanted even though the conclusions of these external monitoring observations were from the OSC were universally negative, they still wanted to tick that box and comply with that international norm. But I think those days are now gone. The country has, of course, become more reliant on other patrons who do not care as much about, do not care at all about democratic norms, i.e. Russia, China, the Gulf states, and therefore they see no need to involve the OSCE anymore. I think another factor that I've heard from sources in the country is that they feel as though the West is distracted with Ukraine, the West is divided over Ukraine with the Trump administration coming in, and there's that this news that the OSCE would not observe the elections would fly under the radar and not be the focal point of anyone's attention at this point in time. So I think it's really a sign that the country, as we've already discussed, and the regime has consolidated its power and ultimately doesn't feel the need to signal even any semblance of democratic or the acceptance or even interactions with the kind of international community at this point.
Thank you. Mukhama John, you're probably watching some of the news broadcasts out of Tajikistan. If I was an average citizen in Tajikistan and I was watching to find out about the upcoming elections, what would I see? Anything?
Of course, comparing to the previous elections, we don't see that much election propaganda on the streets. We don't see brochures. We don't see the stickers on the walls. You don't see that much atmosphere of election. This is one thing. The other things from previous, after the banned RPT, 7 party left back in Tajikistan, and like a Social Democratic Party, they didn't nominate any candidates, and his leader is not known. He's disappeared. He's not coming to the media at all. Shokirjon Hakimov imprisoned it, and we don't hear about Social Party. The Communist Party as well. So only 4 party left, which is managed or governed by the government. So I think the government is planning, from what I observed, this is the final stage of power transaction from Rahmon to his son. Because what I see, like most of the candidates are young generation, like they are, the year of their date birth after 1980. So they are average of 40 years old, 45 years old. So the reason why Rahmon is not loving, I think, observers, first of all, he does not need any, to gain any legitimacy to what Edward added, like not rely on foreign aid anymore, like in this election. And also he don't want the election process to be documented by the foreign observer in order to challenge the legitimacy of the future election, which might turn to presidency of his son Rustam Umali. As ordinary Tajiks, Tajiks are thinking about their today's bread, and they are disappointed. They just think where to find a piece of bread and not to feed their family. They don't think about politics and politicians, and you don't see that much people talking. Society is afraid talking about politics during these elections.
Thank you. Steve, I guess we'll open up a little bit of discussion about the reasons for all this, the succession. And obviously, this is the big question in Tajikistan, not so much who, but when. But, it's really one of those things where every time something happens, people are immediately attribute what just happened in Tajikistan to that being the signal that we're going to have the final succession. First, can you explain what the succession looks like? And second, could you tell me if you think, how would you rate the significance of these recent court trials, the OSCE decision, and that, are we getting closer to the succession, or is this just another example of Tajikistan, the Tajik authorities being cruel for the sake of cruelty?
It's always hard to say, and almost as long as I've been working on Tajikistan, it's probably the same for Ed and Mukhama John lived this. This has been the discussion, or some might say the obsession, of observers, and it becomes almost sort of background noise in the sense that it's always looming, this idea that, you know, the succession from father to son will take place, you know, but as, of course, Central Asia and the wider region have, you know, you've had all these other examples of familial dynasties and successions in Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. There's been more anticipation over the years. And I remember, you know, there were a few times where this was loudly discussed in 2022 when the Pamiria events happened, for example. That was another theory that there was, you know, something related to the succession and that the attempt to suppress the Pamiria uprising was also clearing the political field of any opponents. But essentially, we have Rustam Momali, who is the second official in the country under the constitution. He heads the upper house of parliament. You know, so he's obviously poised to take power, but he's part of a big family where there are lots of interests and monopolies and oligarchies. His two sisters occupying extremely prominent roles and their husbands, something that, you know, Ed has done a lot of research on, for example. But I would say that this is a totalitarian system where certainly President Rahmon is up in years. He's been in power now since 1992. That's the longest reign in the former Soviet space, even more than Lukashenko. So he's the elder statesman of autocracy in this region, and he's sort of well past his prime. There's often periods when he disappears from public view, and there's speculation about his failing health. And so there's lots of reasons to think that this could happen at any time. But I would say, again, I think sometimes we lose focus on the individuals that are getting caught up in these rising numbers of political prisoners, which is now at least in the hundreds. And as I was saying in the beginning of the program, I think Tajikistan at this point, we could say it may be the cruelest and the most repressive in terms of its record on political prisoners. As I was preparing for this discussion, I was looking back at a journalist's sentences, Bruce, and not one sentence that I can see, and I could be corrected on this, has been below 7 years in the last, you know, in the recent period of the last 2 years. And other sentences, we didn't mention this, but the leaders of Group 24 who were kidnapped or disappeared from Turkey got 20 years and 30 years respectively earlier in 2024. And so it's hard to know whether or not this is about sending a message to political potential opponents or dissidents that they better not mess with Rustam when he takes power, or if it's just a paranoid way of doing business, which is just circulating in the bloodstream now for so long, as Mohammad John mentioned, going back to the early 2000s when we saw these first kidnappings of political opponents, you know, over the last 25 years, quarter century. And I think the real tragedy here is the impunity that has been allowed to become the norm when in terms of the approach of the international community to Tajikistan is really what allows this all to happen. So we'll see whether the succession takes place in 2025 or 2026. It will likely happen soon, though, given his age and his health.
Thank you. Edward, what does this say about the popularity of the Rahmon regime? I mean, you know, they have to put so many people in jail. How stable do you assess the Rahmon regime to really be? Is this overkill on their part? They seem to need to clear out anybody who's even remotely a potential threat to them.
Sure. If I can add maybe another development that we hadn't discussed that's linked to Steve's points, that's the recent transfer or the retirement and of Beg Beg Zakhurov, who was at one point the head of the communications committee, and the also very powerful prosecutor Yusuf Rahmon, who was removed from his position as prosecutor general and transferred to become head of the Security Council. I think those are also important developments. Two individuals whose children had married into the Rahmon family, individuals who'd acquired a great degree of power and wealth from those positions, in particular Sabur, being linked to various property companies that controlled apartment complexes in Dushanbe. And Yusuf Rahmon in particular had acquired a great degree of power and had a strong rivalry and conflict with the powerful head of the security services, Saimumin Yatimov. And I think the removal of those two individuals and the replacement in particular of the prosecutor general's office of Vahid Zodar, the former head of the Drugs Control Agency, and Many of his deputies are now individuals who are loyal and owe so much of their career to the patronage of Rustam. And I think that's further evidence that a transition will come at some point, and we're getting towards the end game in that regard. I think it's, in terms of the question of the popularity of the Rahman regime, very difficult to tell, of course, because there is such a climate of fear that pervades the country. You know, we don't have accurate opinion polling data for that very reason. There are very few protests in the country when compared with neighboring states, even such as Uzbekistan, which recently overtook Kyrgyzstan as having the second largest number of protests in the region, at least according to ACLED data. And so, you know, it's very difficult to tell what people are thinking. They aren't able to express their opinions online as they were at some point time about a decade or more ago when the environment was more free. And so it's very difficult to tell. Thus far, the government has been able to rule through a combination of repression and legitimation, largely based around the memories of the civil war hit the country after the breakup of the Soviet Union. But of course, a new generation is coming to the fore, and new ideas on identity related to kind of rising religious feelings and sentiments amongst the new generation are emerging. And so at this point, it's very difficult to tell how popular the government is. Ultimately, thus far, they've relied on the acquiescence of the population, and there's no reason to think that won't remain the same in the coming years. But very difficult to answer that question, really, given the repressive environment that pervades.
Okay, thank you. Well, come on, John, I want to get your opinion on this also. You know, you're surely talking with people in Tajikistan, understanding that no one's free to voice their opinion in a public forum, and you don't dare write this stuff on and post it on internet, social media sites, let alone go out in public and say it. But amongst the people, what are the people amongst themselves, what do you hear them saying about the situation in Tajikistan and the government there?
It is very challenging and difficult. There is no accurate tools to evaluate the popularity of the regime. And also the regime run the strong propaganda, controlling entire media, for example, whenever they show on news, like something happening, something bad happening in US, for example, fire or airplane crash or something, accident, they will just put on air and say, look what's happening in America. And then you see the positive news on Tajikistan, like, look, this is the best country you are living in. So they have a strong manipulation and brainwashing machine and the entire media controlled by the government, the immigrants, and for example, who are leaving the Tajikistan, just when they are coming to Europe, they are avoiding being in contact with exile activists, fearing of them being persecuted back in Tajikistan. So this is very close country becoming worse than, or maybe close to, or comparing worse than Turkmenistan. And it's very difficult to evaluate. Many times we see like dictators falling. There seems to be very strong and powerful like Assad, and next day you see it is falling. So we don't know. It is very difficult. If I say like it's not popular, so why are still the Rahman is running the country for past 33 years. If I say it's popular, so it might be also true. But the only thing what I know, the population of Tajikistan is under the strong propaganda of the Rahman regime, and many of them are buying this propaganda and believing in what the government running media feeding them. So they have no alternative in order to compare their situation with surrounding world and to have independent and verified information.
Bruce, can I piggyback on something Muhammad John was just saying?
Oh, go ahead.
Well, he just raises yet another category in a way of political prisoner and issue, in the sense that those that have fled to Europe seeking a safe haven, I think one of the most shameful, more recent chapters of this story of repression is the way in which European countries and other states have been complicit in the repression by sending people back to certain torture and lengthy political imprisonment. I'm talking about Germany primarily, where we've been seeing some reporting on, and we don't know all the numbers of those that have been deported, but we know of several cases in 2024 and 2023, Dilmurel Dergashev, or the earlier case of Abdul Osham Sidin, people with known ties to either political opposition or accused or perceived to be, and German migration officers saying, closing their eyes to that fact and sending them back in violation of the European Convention of Human Rights and other human rights obligations to a country where they know very well that these individuals will be tortured. We've seen Austria do this. We saw Poland do this with Farukh Ekromov. And then we mentioned earlier people being disappeared and kidnapped from Turkey. And of course, Russia is the leading country from which people are being sent back. And I think all of that necessitates us to ask why, in the face of this unrelenting repression inside Tajikistan, at the very least, you would expect that the EU and the United States and other states would refrain from violating their obligation of what we say is non-refoulement. That's the obligation not to return someone back to torture. So that's been, I think, also incredibly shocking. And we don't know just how many people have been deported to torture, but we know a number of these names. And I think we can't forget them, and we have to push for there to be changes in that regard.
Okay, thank you. We're coming up to the end of the show, and I will let everyone have a last comment. But I would also like to ask if you have a chance to. In the past, we've talked about Tajikistan, and I know with you, Steve, we've spoken, and you say pressure works on these governments. Is there anybody out there who can pressure the Tajik government at this point? I mean, with all that's going on in the world, the attention isn't even on Tajikistan. So is there anybody that you could even think of that would have the time or the focus to actually level criticism at Tajikistan and try to get them to change their ways, so to speak? Edward, I'll start with you.
Well, of course, the U.S. government had historically been critical of the regime, putting out obviously reports on human rights and being quite vocal in raising these issues in private. Of course, now with the transition to the new administration, for whom this does not seem to be a priority, so with the new Trump administration moving closer towards Russia and becoming more critical of its allies, you know, I think that's a source of criticism we are unlikely to see in the future. And ultimately, I think I fail to see many outside actors really having enough leverage, with the exception of countries like Russia and China, to really change the country's trajectory with the current government in place. Ultimately, whilst we, of course, should continue raising these cases amongst civil society and attempting to lobby governments, particularly in Europe, to raise these cases, the outlook is unfortunately relatively bleak.
What about John? You're in Europe. Do you see anybody that's actually still paying enough attention to Tajikistan to try to get them to change their ways?
Unfortunately, I don't see that there is no pressure from the Western country. Edward mentioned U.S. pressure in private, but I think from what I have heard, the Tajik government stopped it. The bilateral conversation about human rights and security of human rights issues for the past 2 years with the State Department, and they never had such a, even Turkmenistan held such a conversation with the U.S. government. But Europe has several pressure on Tajikistan. If they want to use, for example, Tajikistan is interested to join the free trade agreement with Europe. So they could use this opportunity as a pressure in order to force government of Tajikistan to be accountable. This is one thing. The other, there are a lot of investment or foreign aid going from European countries, from Swiss, from Germany, French, to Tajikistan. They also could, you know, in return to these funds, ask government to hold his international commitment and also sanctioning human rights abusers, for example, people who are torturing people inside prison, who are killing prisoners, who are sentencing political prisoners. They could just sanction them at the European country or at the level of the European Union or states like European countries. So all these are measures of pressure, and also the civil society and of media, exile media. So if they are supporting exile media, and the exile media right now is the only opportunity, the only windows of the hub for the change in the future. So with the delivering right information, true information, and alternative information to the audience, to the population of Tajikistan, there would be a chance to change narrative in the future. And using this opportunity, I would call to U.S. congressmen to keep continuing supporting the Radio Free Europe or Radio Liberty, because Radio Azadi is the only independent media which is operating inside Tajikistan for now. So I think these are the tools which European countries could use to pressure on Rahmon, especially sanctioning individuals and members of his government.
Steve, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, thanks. You know, Bruce, I think it was, I was looking back, you and I wrote a piece called Can Social Media Deliver Justice in Tajikistan back in 2018. And, you know, that was about the case of a journalist that was imprisoned in northern Tajikistan, Khujan. His name was Khairullo Mirsaidov, if you remember that case. And he was, when I was thinking about when does pressure work, right? Well, he was released after a sort of grassroots, you could say, a global campaign, hashtags and people all over the world holding up signs, free Khairullo, free Khairullo. And I remember that was led, you know, by his colleagues, by his friends. There were also some local NGOs that attended the trial in Khujan, and he was eventually released. He fled the country. He's happily outside of Tajikistan now. And the only other political prisoner that I can remember, and maybe Ed and Muhammad Jung can tell me if I'm thinking of someone else, there's another one, but was Alexander Sadikov, who was a researcher who was arrested also on charges of espionage back in, I believe it was 2014, in the Gabao region. Those two individuals out of the dozens of people we've been discussing, out of the hundreds of political prisoners. And in those two cases, you could say the only common denominator was public pressure, this combination of various voices and mechanisms coming into play. You had, in the Sadikov case, you had some high-level American government officials getting involved. You had interest from the UN special rapporteurs. And I think, I mean, I completely agree with what Muhammad John had said just now about individual sanctions being brought to bear on Tajik officials that are perpetrating these abuses. I do think that, you know, despite the really depressing nature of our conversation today, I think that, you know, these regimes do react when pressed. I think that, of course, Tajikistan differs in the respect from places like Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, where we have seen people released more often or pardoned. That hasn't been the case, especially in recent years in Tajikistan. So it's our job right now, I think, to innovate these new strategies, to use the individual sanctions. And the last thing that I'll mention, Bruce, and the lawyer in me just can't resist, is that because these crimes that we've been discussing, they are crimes, they are systematic, and they are widespread, I would say that we're dealing with such a critical mass of victims now that we can really safely speak about what I would call crimes against humanity. That's systematic and widespread attacks. In this case, you know, mass torture, political imprisonment. And when you have that, you can go to the International Criminal Court, of which Tajikistan is a member. They are in the jurisdiction of that court. It's in The Hague. And Tajikistan signed and ratified that treaty. And so that's another avenue that I think, in this particularly difficult environment where the United States is dropping off of its commitments and the EU doesn't appear that interested and everyone is distracted and Putin is asserting himself, this is an environment in which I think we have to look again to the grassroots, to the social media campaigns, to the activists and journalists like Muhammad John and others, and the families, the relatives who are committed to justice, to utilizing those mechanisms in the United Nations and places like the International Criminal Court.
Okay, thank you. Actually, that's good. It's a sort of a positive note to end on. I'm sorry we have to end the discussion right now. I'm sure we're going to be coming back to this, especially if there really is a succession that comes this year. But I'd like to thank you, Steve, Muhammad John, and Edward for being on the program. Big thank you to Rowan Humphreys and Emmy Caroli, our Mezzalis podcast producers in Washington, D.C. And I'd like to take a moment to thank Nathan Shoemaker, who was the Mezzalis podcast producer for the last 3 years and has recently been promoted to a new position. Best of luck with your new job, Nathan. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mezzalis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon.